Welcome to today's reading of the Council Buffs Daily Nonpareil for January 1st, 2021. Happy New Year! I'm your reader, Wanda, and here's our first story. Drummy, no water increase in 2021. Water rates will remain flat in Council Bluffs. The Council Bluffs Water Works Board of Trustees recently approved the facility's 2021 budget, which will not include a rise in rates. "We're not raising water rates in 2021, said Waterworks CEO and General Manager Doug Drummy. Drummy said with the dry weather in 2020, which saw long stretches of drought, water usage was high, translating to strong revenue for the waterworks. Revenues were strong, Drummy said. We were able to hold our expenses and maintain services. We made decisions not to request a water rate increase. With everything going on with the pandemic, we felt that would be best. Drummy noted that individual water use habits vary greatly. For one of many variation examples, he noted a person with a big yard who waters it compared to someone with a smaller yard who doesn't water it. The average Council Bluffs Waterworks residential customer uses 50,000 gallons per year for a total annual cost of $270, which comes to $22.50 per month. Drummy noted most residential customers are billed bi-monthly. Drummy stressed this was for water only, with sewer service charges included with the water bill. Sewer charges are collected by the Council Bluffs Water Works on behalf of the city. Water Works is projecting operating revenue of $12,877,000 in 2021, a decrease of $575,000 or 4.3% compared to the 2020 re-estimated budget, according to information provided by Drummy. While the budget reflects some growth in water sales due to customer base growth, we recognize that water sales may not be as strong in 2021 as compared to 2020, since it was a very dry year, Drummy said. As noted, every budget year, water sales can be significantly influenced by economic and climatic variables beyond our control. The facility anticipates operating expenses of $9,023,400, an increase of $485,400 or 5.6% over the 2020 re-estimated budget. The increase is due to several factors, including water treatment, chemical costs, material costs, labor costs, and insurance costs, according to Drummy. The budget includes the filling of two full-time positions, including purification department coordinator and instrument technician. Next article. Tom Hauser Memorial includes Day of Remembrance and events. Sunday is Sergeant Thomas E. Hauser Day in Council Bluffs and Pottawatomie County. Hauser, a St. Albert graduate and a U.S. Marine, died on January 3, 2005 in Anbar Province, Iraq, while assigned to the 2nd Force Reconnaissance 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force to support the Operation Iraqi Freedom, according to organizers of a Tom Hauser Memorial Facebook page. In honor of Hauser's death, organizers asked the county and city to declare the date Tom Hauser died, Tom Hauser Day. The Board of Supervisors did so recently, and the City Council is set to at its first meeting of the new year. Other activities to honor Hauser include: On Sunday, Catholic parishes in Council Bluffs will have a mass served in Hauser's name. A CrossFit workout of the day will be created to honor Tom for those inclined to complete on January 3rd. The workout will be published on the Tom Hauser Memorial Facebook page. There will be a gathering at 1892 on the 100 block from noon to 4 p.m. Sunday to celebrate Hauser's life, share stories, and reminisce, organizers said. Lastly, something we are very excited about. An application has been submitted to the City of Council Bluffs for a commemorative renaming of Gleason Avenue to Sergeant Thomas E. Hauser Way. Councilman Chad Hannon explained the process includes putting commemorative street signs on existing signs. The signs are paid for by organizers and not with taxpayer funds. January 1st, Face of the Day, Lyle Rodenberg. Lyle Rodenberg is always putting smiles on the faces at Bethany Heights. Rodenberg, who is turning 92 this spring, grew up in the Tri-Center area. He attended Underwood High School, and he graduated in 1946. He married Rosalie Goldapp in 1951. The two farmed in the Bentley area for many years after. He would later quit farming, but stayed in the agriculture field. He worked as the branch manager at Farm Service Co-op in Neola for 25 years. Rodenberg was married to Rosalie for nearly 70 years, and she passed away in 2017. They had four kids and were blessed with even more grandchildren, nieces, and nephews after. Rodenberg and his wife lived in Neola for much of their relationship, but they had to make a change about 5 years ago. They were getting older, and he said they wanted to find an assisted living facility that would suit them best for their later years. They ended up at Bethany Heights in Council Bluffs, and he said it was one of the best decisions he could have made. "Oh, we just love it here," he said. "I'm in a great place, the best place I can be." Before stepping outside for some fresh air and to speak with the Nonpareil Wednesday afternoon, Rodenberg was seen having a playful chat with some Bethany staff members. He said they've always been there for him over the years, and he's grateful for the relationships he's made with them. Rodenberg said it's been a tough year with the COVID-19 pandemic still looming, but things are starting to look up with the rollout of vaccines. Rodenberg, his fellow residents, and the staff members at Bethany Heights and Bethany Lutheran Home received their first two doses on Monday. He said that with his age, he'd like to see things get back to normal sooner rather than later. He wants to get plenty of social time in with his friends and family as soon as possible. He's looking forward to the new year, and he hopes everyone has a great 2021. Next story. Virus aid, police reform dominate new U.S. laws for 2021. Responses to the coronavirus pandemic and police brutality dominated legislative sessions in 2020, leading to scores of new laws that will take effect in the new year. Virus-related laws included those offering help to essential workers, boosting unemployment benefits, and requiring time off for sick employees. A resolution in Alabama formally encouraged first fist bumping over handshakes. Legislatures also addressed police use of force against Black people and others of color after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis led to widespread protests against police brutality. Among other things, new laws will mandate oversight and reporting, create civilian review panels, and require more disclosures about problem officers. States including California, Delaware, Iowa, New York, Oregon, and Utah passed bans on police chokeholds. Floyd, who was black, died after a white officer pressed a knee into his neck for several minutes while being recorded on video, even as Floyd pleaded for air. New York State Assemblyman Walter T. Mosley noted that hundreds of black men and women killed at the hands of police between the cries of "I Can't Breathe" by Eric Gardner, who died after being put in a chokehold by New York City police in 2014, and those of Floyd in May. Mosley, a Brooklyn Democrat who is black, said the Eric Garner Anti-Chokehold Act was an important step forward, but it will not be the last. Despite reforms in some states, the response to Floyd's death was not uniform. Several use of force or disciplinary proposals in several other states failed, and some even moved in the opposite direction. Georgia created a new crime beginning January 1st, defined as bias-motivated intimidation, which would apply to the death or serious bodily injury of police, firefighters, and emergency personnel. It also extended to cases involving more than $500 worth of damage to their property because of actual or perceived employment as a first responder. Violations are punishable by 1 to 5 years in prison and a fine of as much as $5,000. The law was passed by Republicans over the objections of Democrats and civil liberties groups who said police already have enough protections. Republicans insisted on the law as part of a deal to pass a new hate crimes law in Georgia that drew bipartisan support. While legislatures tackled some elements of the coronavirus outbreak this year, more sessions had ended before the current wave of cases, deaths, and renewed stay-at-home orders. Lawmakers of both major parties have vowed to make the pandemic response a centerpiece of their 2021 sessions, addressing issues ranging from school reopenings to governor's emergency powers. The virus also focused attention on the nation's uneven and expensive health care system. Tackling issues of coverage and cost were common themes in 2020. A Washington measure caps the monthly out-of-pocket cost of insulin at $100 until January 1, 2023, and requires the state health care authority to monitor the price of insulin. A new Connecticut law requires pharmacists to dispense a 30-day emergency supply of diabetes-related drugs and devices with a price cap for diabetics who have less than 1 week's supply. Both laws take effect January 1st. It's unconscionable that anyone should have to limit or go without a common and widely available life-saving drug on an emergency basis in America in 2021, Connecticut Senator Derek Slapp, a West Hartford Democrat, said in a statement. A much-anticipated Medicaid expansion is coming in Oklahoma in the new year after years of resistance from Republicans in the legislature and the governor's office. Voters narrowly approved a constitutional amendment expanding the federal state insurance program to an additional estimated 215,000 low-income residents. It takes effect in July. Lawmakers must determine how to cover the projected $164 million state share during their 2021 session. The cost could be considerably higher, given the number of Oklahomans who have lost their jobs and work-related health insurance because of the pandemic. Republican Governor Kevin Stitt had urged voters to reject the plan. He said the state would have to either raise taxes or cut services somewhere else, like education, first responders, or roads and bridges to pay for the expansion. A new law in Georgia aims to limit consumers from getting stuck with surprise medical bills by requiring insurers in many cases to pay for care by a doctor or at a hospital not within their network of providers. The law protects patients from financial responsibility beyond what they would normally have to pay. Instead, insurers and providers can take disputes to the state insurance commissioner. Minnesota also has what's being called a continuity of care law going into effect January 1st. On other notable laws taking effect in the new year, voters in Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota approved measures legalizing recreational marijuana. New Jersey's democratically led legislature and Democratic Governor Phil Murphy are working to set up a legal marketplace and to update laws already on the books to decriminalize marijuana possession. Colorado will prohibit landlords from refusing to show rent or lease housing based on a person's source of income or involvement in the type of contract required to receive public housing assistance. Landlords can still do credit checks, but the act makes it an unfair housing practice unless they've conducted checks for every possible tenant. New Hampshire will make multiple changes to state laws regarding sexual assault. Starting January 1st, the definition of sexual assault will be expanded to include any sexual contact between school employees and students between the ages of 13 and 18. Previously, such contact could be considered consensual and not a crime if the student was 16 or 17. Other legislation taking effect in mid-January increases protection for sexual assault victims and requires colleges and universities to adopt sexual misconduct policies. The bill requires colleges to provide free access to medical and legal support services, anti-retaliation protections, confidential advising services, data on sexual violence, and prevention and response training. Georgia will require an audit starting in 2021 before movies and television productions are awarded the state's generous tax credit, which has allowed the highest subsidies of any states. The credit, which rebates up to 30% of a production's value, costs nearly $900 million in foregone tax revenues in 2019, as movie and TV production boomed in Georgia. Estimations were highly critical. Examinations were highly critical of the tax credit, finding some companies that received tax credits didn't earn them. California will require companies based there to have at least one board director by the end of 2021 who is a racial or sexual minority, with larger numbers required by 2022. Companies with 100 or more employees also must start sending information on employees' race, ethnicity, and gender to the state. Connecticut employers must begin taking deductions from their employees' paychecks for a new paid family and medical leave program under a state law passed in 2019. The state's estimated 100,000 businesses will be responsible for holding 0.5% from worker wages. Qualified employees can begin receiving benefits on January 1st, 2022. Massachusetts also begins a new paid family medical leave program in the new year. It offers a 12-week benefit in most cases, extending to 26 weeks for those caring for a military member undergoing treatment. Oklahoma will extend a property tax exemption for religious institutions to include property owned by a church if it conducts instruction for children from pre-K to grade 12. Contributing to this report were Associated Press writers Jeff Amy in Atlanta, Mike Catalini in Trenton, New Jersey, Sue Hay in Hartford, Connecticut, Steve Karnowski in Minneapolis, Rachel LaCourte in Olympia, Washington, Jeff LeBlanc in Boston, Sean Murphy in Oklahoma City, Patricia Nieberg in Denver, Holly Raymer in Concord, New Hampshire, Don Thompson in Sacramento, California, and Lindsay Whitehurst in Salt Lake City. Nieberg is a core member of the Associated Press Report for America State House News Initiative. Report for America is a nonprofit national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues. Waterloo Code Girl breaks silence on World War II service before turning 100. In the space of about a year, Dolores Shack Burdett went from working in the office of the Rath Packing Company to help turn the tide of the battle in the Pacific in World War II. But she couldn't talk about what she did for decades. A 1938 graduate of East High School who grew up on High Street near the school, she joined the U.S. Navy Waves Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service and was part of a top-secret code-breaking unit. Burdett, who now lives in Florida, was a member of the United States Naval Communication Intelligence Organization based in Washington, D.C. She was a Navy Intelligence Communications Specialist. That was nearly 80 years ago. She turns 100 on January 18th. We decoded the Japanese messages. It was really quite an experience, Burdett said. From New Smyrna Beach, Florida, where she lives. Our fleet intercepted the messages, and when they came to us, we decoded them, Burdett said. On one occasion, she said, I had gotten the message, and it was telling about how the Japanese were planning to attack one of the islands. We got the message transcribed and out to our fleet, and they destroyed that Japanese fleet. But we couldn't discuss anything about her work, only within the walls of that room, she said. It was that secret. It was so secret, Burdett said, that she couldn't even discuss an award she received for her work after the war. The Navy awarded the Naval Communications Intelligence Organization, including Burdett, a unit commendation for their work, but the notification letter she received about the award said, it is directed that because of the nature of the services performed by this unit, no publicity be given to your receipt of this reward. I couldn't tell my husband. Nobody, she said. I packed it away in the bank. It was there for 50 years, and after 50 years, they said I could talk about it. And her husband, Glenn, originally from Tennessee, was a career Navy man. All he knew was I was in communication. I couldn't tell him anything more. They married during the war, having been introduced through a mutual acquaintance in Washington. Of their first date, she said, I went out that night and spent the whole evening discussing how we were against wartime marriages, and then we got married. Glenn subsequently served in the Philippines during the war. The couple lived in Waterloo for a time after the war. Glenn returned to the Navy and served 26 years, through Korea and Vietnam, and 25 years with the U.S. General Services Administration in Washington, before he retired and they moved to Florida. They were married 70 years with 2 children and 3 grandchildren, and he died in 2014 at age 92. She misses him terribly. She also remembers an office co-worker from Wrath, Bob Mansky, who also joined the Navy and was killed on the USS Arizona in the December 7, 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that plunged the U.S. into the war. She enlisted with the Waves shortly thereafter. Now that I'm going to be 100 years old, I look back on it and I've had quite a life. That was an experience not many people had. In 2017, her unit received some long overdue recognition with the publication of a New York Times best-selling book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II by Liza Monday. Since then, she's talked more about her service and had articles in the local Florida papers. It's ironic, she said, that I was at the beauty shop and one of the fellows that worked there said, "Can you believe that's the woman who kept her mouth shut for 50 years? But that's what we did. We knew how important it was. In November 1945, after she'd left the Navy, she received a letter from U.S. Secretary of Navy James Forrestal, underscoring the importance of her work. "I want the Navy's pride in you, which is my privilege to express, to reach into your civilian life and remain with you always," she said. It has, and it will. She still has her Navy unit commendation pin stored carefully away. Her children know where to find it. It was pinned on her and laid to rest. It will be pinned on her and laid on to rest upon her passing. Next article, Pence seeks dismissal of suit aiming to overturn election. The Justice Department has asked a federal judge to dismiss a last gasp lawsuit led by a House Republican that seeks to give Vice President Mike Pence the power to overturn the results of the presidential election won by Joe Biden when Congress formally counts the Electoral College votes next week. Pence, as president of the Senate, will oversee the Wednesday session and declare the winner of the White House race. The Electoral College this month cemented Biden's 306 to 232 victory and multiple legal efforts by President Donald Trump's campaign to challenge the results have failed. The suit names Pence, who has a largely ceremonial role in next week's proceedings, as the defendant and asked the court to throw out the 1887 law that spells out how Congress handles the vote counting. It asserts that the vice president may exercise the exclusive authority and sole discretion in determining which electoral votes to count for a given state. The Justice Department is representing Pence in a case that aims to find a way to keep his boss, President Donald Trump, in power. In a court filing in Texas on Wednesday, the department said Representative Louis Gohmert, a Republican Texas, and a group of Republican electors from Arizona have sued the wrong defendant, if in fact any of those suing actually have a judicially cognizant claim. It is the role prescribed for the Senate and the House of Republicans in the Electoral Count Act to which plaintiffs object, not any action that Vice President Pence has taken, a suit to establish that the Vice President has discretion over the count, filed against the Vice President is a walking legal contradiction. Trump, the first president to lose a re-election bid in almost 30 years, has attributed his defeat to widespread voter fraud, but a range of nonpartisan election officials and Republicans has confirmed there was no fraud in the November contest and that would change the results of the election. That includes former Attorney General William Barr, who said he saw no reason to appoint a special counsel to look into the president's claims about the 2020 election. He resigned from his post last week. Trump and his allies have filed roughly 50 lawsuits challenging election results, and nearly all have been dismissed or dropped. He also lost twice at the Supreme Court. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Joyce F. Maurer, M-A-U-R-E-R, age 79 of Council Bluff, passed away December 27, 2020, at Bethany Lutheran Home. Joyce was born May 5, 1941, in Council Bluffs, to the late Walter and Irma Fairman. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1959. Joyce worked for Northwestern Bell Telephone Company for many years. In addition to her parents, Joyce was preceded in death by her daughter Cynthia Hytrek in 2010. Joyce is survived by her son Alvin Maurer Jr., daughters Debbie Costello and Kathy Strzok, all of Council Bluffs, 4 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, sister Mary Poe, and brother Loyal Fairman, both of Council Bluffs. Joyce has been cremated and no services will be held. Sports. Fiesta Bowl. College football power full line pushes ISU to New Year's 6 bowl. Before the season began, Iowa State coach Matt Campbell said he thought that this 2020 offensive line room was the most talented room he's had at Iowa State. He went a step further to say it had a chance to be the best. Iowa State had just graduated 4 members of its offensive line from 2019, and its center was coming back from injury. He was putting a lot of faith in a lot of young, unproven players. Campbell doesn't like to evaluate the offensive line position until after the season because they need to be good from start to finish. And with 4 new faces along the line, it had a chance of wearing down. Having been an offensive line coach, the first thing I think we all know how long it takes to recruit, develop, and really maintain those guys, offensive coordinator Tom Manning said. And really, the credit goes to those guys. I mean, there's a lot of young players that have helped. They have some injuries there. We've had to mix a lot of different guys in there. They've done a really good job. The one thing we've been excited about is throughout the season, we do feel like those guys have gotten better fundamentally, and they've maintained their strength, which is sometimes a challenge, particularly with young players on the offensive line. It's a position where you can get worn down quickly. Manning mentioned the injuries. Iowa State's one returning offensive lineman from 2019 was Trevor Downing. Downing got injured in Iowa State's first game against Louisiana and was replaced by freshman Daryl Simmons. By the end of the first game, Colin Newell was the only one with meaningful experience that played in 2019 or 2018. On the top of the injury to Downing, Joey Ramos started the season at right tackle before getting injured and being replaced with freshman Jake Remsburg. Remsburg got injured in the Big 12 championship game, and Ramos was able to fill back in for him. All Iowa State's line done this season, while navigating injuries and inexperience, was blocked for the leading rusher in the nation and protect the Big 12 first-team quarterback in Brock Purdy. Iowa State's line gave up the fewest sacks in the Big 12 and had the best tackle for a loss differential in the nation at plus 32 en route to the program's first ever New Year's Six Bowl, the Fiesta Bowl. You know, it's a tough position, Newell said. It's a position that takes a while to develop, and Coach Campbell, Coach Jeff Myers, Coach Manning, all those guys have done an absolutely wonderful job just developing us. It's a learned position, and they've done a good job of teaching us. Iowa State has come a long way from Campbell's first season in 2016, when Iowa State had the eighth fewest rushing yards in the Big 12 and gave up the most sacks. When we came in here, the level of where we were in terms of that offensive line, it was down in terms of scholarship numbers, almost to the bare bones, Campbell said. The ability to have to rebuild that from the ground up was probably more there than anywhere in our football program. There's not a lot of quick fixes at Iowa State. We're always going to be a developmental program, and nothing takes longer to develop than the offensive line. It's a learned skill. It's a learned trait. And I just think that it's taken time to get that room to where it needs to be from a competitive standpoint, from a depth standpoint. While both Campbell and Manning were former offensive line coaches, Campbell wants Myers to get his fair share. Give a lot of credit to Coach Myers, Campbell said. I think he's done an absolutely incredible job of taking that development to the next level. And both from a recruiting standpoint and really from a physical developmental standpoint. I think it's a group that still isn't a finished product, still has ability to continue to grow, and that part is really exciting. The offensive line has made big steps from where it was 4 years ago and where it was even a year ago. American interest wanes in getting COVID-19 vaccine. Why? Health experts agree that the best way to end the COVID-19 pandemic is to vaccinate our way out of it. Unfortunately, Americans' willingness to get a COVID-19 vaccine is waning, even as a punishing third wave claims well over 1,000 U.S. lives each day. The latest evidence for this appears this week in the Journal of American Medical Association, and it shows that skepticism toward the vaccines is on the rise among Americans of all stripes. Regardless of age, race, or sex, U.S. adults were significantly less likely to say they'd get vaccinated in late November and early December than they were in early April. Unlike other surveys that measured American sentiment about COVID-19 vaccines at a single point in time, this one has tracked changes in the same group for more than 8,000 people since the early days of the pandemic. Critical trials suggested the vaccine from Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna are safe and highly effective. But that good news couldn't stem a nearly 18% drop in Americans' willingness to be vaccinated, the authors of the JAMA report said. Overall, 74.1% of U.S. adults surveyed between April 1st and April 14th said they were either somewhat or very likely to get a COVID-19 vaccine when it became available to them. At the time, the country had confirmed about 550,000 coronavirus infections and nearly 22,000 people had died as a result, according to the data from the World Health Organization. Fast forward to the end of the year. Between November 25th and December 8th, 56.2% of U.S. adults were still planning to get vaccinated when their turn came. This despite the fact that by the end of that survey period, more than 14.5 million Americans had been infected and about 280,000 had died, according to the WHO. Women are less likely than men to accept the vaccine. In recent weeks, only 50.6% of them said they planned to get vaccinated, down from 69.5% in April. Among men, interest in immunization fell from 79.1% in the spring to 62.3% 8 months later. When asked recently, 80.6% of Asian Americans said they would get a COVID-19 vaccine. That sounds like a lot, but it was even higher in April, 90.9%. No other racial or ethnic group is anywhere near as interested in a COVID vaccine. Only 58.6% of white Americans surveyed in November and December said they'd get one, down from 77.8% in April. Along with 52.7% of Latinx Americans, down from 73.1%, and a mere 37.6% of Black Americans, down from 50.7%. Enthusiasm for COVID-19 vaccine increases with age, but that too has diminished over time. Americans aged 65 and up remain most keen on the vaccine, with 69.1% of those surveyed recently saying they'd get it. That compares with 57% of people ages 50 to 64 and 50.9% of people in the 18 to 49 age group. Back in April, 69.1% was the low end of the spectrum. That was the percentage of 18 to 49-year-olds who said they planned to get vaccinated. They were joined by 76.7% of people in the 50 to 64 age group and 83.8% of senior citizens. The study also examined differences associated with educational background. The authors found that the more time people spent in school, the more likely they were to want a vaccine. In November and December, 70.3% of those who had finished college said they planned to get vaccinated when they could, down from 85% in April. At the other end of the spectrum, 47.6% of those with a high school diploma or less intended to get vaccinated, down from 67% in April. The results come courtesy of USC's Understanding America study, which has been asking members of a nationally representative panel about issues related to COVID-19 over 2 weeks since March. Unlike other surveys that measured American sentiments about COVID-19 vaccines at a single point in time, this has tracked changes in the same group of more than 8,000 people since the early days of the pandemic. In each two-week period between 5,259 and 6,139 answered the questions they were asked in either English or Spanish. Although the U.S. Food and Drug Administration hasn't authorized any COVID-19 vaccines by the time of the last survey was completed, early results from clinical trials suggested the vaccine candidates from Pfizer and BioNTech and from Moderna were safe and highly effective. But even that good news couldn't stem a nearly 18% drop in Americans' willingness to be vaccinated, the authors of the JAMA report lamented. Educational campaigns to raise public willingness to consider COVID-19 vaccination are needed, concluded the team of researchers from USC, UCLA, and the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Low likelihood of getting COVID-19 vaccines among Black individuals and those with lower educational backgrounds is especially concerning because of their disproportionately higher burden from COVID-19 disease, they added. Biden's pick to lead Treasury made over $7 million in speaking fees. President-elect Joe Biden's choice to be Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, collected more than $7 million in speaking fees in 2019 and 2020 from major financial firms and tech giants, including Citi, Goldman Sachs, and Google, according to disclosure forms filed as part of her nomination. Yellen's was one of three financial disclosures filed by Biden transition officials that were made public on Thursday by the Office of Government Ethics. In a separate filing, Yellen listed firms and banks where she had received speaking fees and said she intended to seek written authorization from ethics officials to participate personally and substantially in matters involving them. Yellen was the Federal Reserve Chair from 2014 to 2018. Her term was not renewed by President Donald Trump. Her selection by Biden will lead the Treasury Department to lead the Treasury Department has been cheered by progressive Democrats who support Yellen's work as a labor economist who has long prioritized combating economic inequality. Since her nomination was announced, Yellen has pledged to work to combat systemic racism and climate change. But receiving steep payments from Wall Street bankers and other powerful corporations could become an issue as her nomination works its way through a closely divided and potentially contentious Senate. Hillary Clinton faced criticism from the left wing of the Democratic Party while running for president in 2016 for having received past lucrative speaking fees at Wall Street firms. Also released Thursday were disclosure forms from Biden's choice to be Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who detailed advising clients, including Bank of America and Facebook, as part of a consulting firm he co-founded. Avril Haines, Biden's choice to be National Intelligence Director, disclosed being a consultant at the same firm, West Exec Advisors. Trump's push for 2,000K checks flops as GOP-led Senate won't vote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell all but shut the door Wednesday on President Donald Trump's push for $2,000 COVID-19 relief checks, declaring Congress had provided enough pandemic aid as he blocked another attempt by Democrats to force a vote. The GOP leader made clear he is unwilling to budge despite political pressure from Trump and even some fellow Republican senators demanding action. Trump wants the recently approved $600 in aid increased threefold, but McConnell dismissed the idea of bigger survival checks, saying the money would go to plenty of American households that just don't need it. McConnell's refusal to act means the additional relief Trump wanted is all but dead. We just approved almost $1 trillion in aid a few days ago, McConnell said, referring to the year-end package Trump signed into law. McConnell added, if specific struggling households still need more help, the Senate will consider smart, targeted aid, not another fire hose of borrowed money. The showdown between the outgoing president and his own Republican Party over the $2,000 checks has thrown Congress into a chaotic year-end session just days before new lawmakers are set to be sworn into office. It's one last standoff, together with the override of Trump's veto of a sweeping defense bill that will punctuate the president's final days and deepen the GOP's divide between its new wing of Trump-styled populists and what had been mainstay conservative views against government spending. Trump has been berating the GOP leaders and tweeted $2,000 ASAP. For a second day in a row, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer tried to force a vote on the bill approved by the House, meeting Trump's demand for $2,000 checks. What we're seeing right now is Leader McConnell trying to kill the checks. The $2,000 checks desperately needed by so many American families, Schumer said at the Capitol. The roadblock set by Senate Republicans appears insurmountable. Most GOP senators seem to accept the inaction, even as a growing number of Republicans, including two senators in runoff elections on January 5th in Georgia, agree with Trump's demand, some very wary of balking him. Congress had settled on smaller $600 payments in a compromise over the big year-end COVID relief and government funding bill that Trump reluctantly signed into law. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said those checks will begin to go out Wednesday. When the Georgia Senate runoff election days away, leading Republicans warned that the GOP's refusal to provide more aid as the virus worsens could jeopardize the outcome of those races. Georgia's GOP Senator David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are in the fights of their political lives against Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in runoff elections that will determine which party has the Senate majority. The two Republicans announced support for Trump's plan on checks. The Senate Republicans risk throwing away two seats and control of the Senate, said Newt Gingrich, the former congressional leader on Fox News. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, "These Republicans in the Senate seem to have an endless tolerance for other people's sadness." Saying little, McConnell has tried to shield his divided Republicans from a difficult vote. On Wednesday, he provided his most fulsome views yet, suggesting he had kept his word to start a process to address Trump's demands, even if it means no votes will actually be taken. "It's no secret Republicans have a diversity of views," he said. Earlier, McConnell had unveiled a new bill loaded up with Trump's other priorities as a possible off-ramp for the stalemate. It included the $2,000 checks as well as a complicated repeal of protections for tech companies like Facebook and Twitter under Section 230 of a communications law that the president complained is unfair to conservatives. It also tacked on the establishment of a bipartisan commission to review the 2020 presidential election Trump lost to President-elect Joe Biden. Democrats oppose that approach, and it does not have enough support in Congress to pass. No votes on additional COVID aid are scheduled. For McConnell, the procedural moves allows him to check the box over the commitment he made when Trump was defiantly refusing to sign off on the big year-end package last weekend. To ensure the president was comfortable signing the bill into law, the Senate committed to beginning one process that would combine three of the president's priorities, McConnell said. That was a commitment, and that's what happened. Liberal conservatives led by Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who supports the relief aid, are blocking action on the defense bill until a vote can be taken on Trump's demand for $2,000 for most Americans. Sanders thundered on the floor that McConnell should call his own constituents in the GOP leader's home state of Kentucky and find out how they feel about the need for immediate help in terms of a $2,000 check. Joining Trump, Republican Senators Josh Hawley of Missouri and Marco Rubio of Florida, among the party's potential 2024 presidential hopefuls, also pushed the party in the president's direction. Hawley is also leading Trump's challenge January 6th to the Electoral College result tally in Congress. other Republicans panned the bigger checks, arguing during the lively Senate debate that the nearly $400 billion price tag was too high. The relief is not targeted to those in need, and Washington has already dispatched ample sums on COVID aid. Senator Pat Toomey, Republican, Pennsylvania, reiterated that he would block the House bill. He said blindly borrowing billions so we can send $2,000 checks to millions of people who haven't lost any income is terrible policy. Considered a long shot, Trump's demand gained momentum at the start of the week when dozens of House Republicans calculated it was better to link with most Democrats than defy the outgoing president. They helped pass a bill raising the payments with robust two-thirds vote of approval. As Trump's push fizzled out in the Senate, the debate over the size and scope of the year-end package, $900 billion in COVID-19 aid, and $1.4 trillion to fund government agencies through September, will linger as potentially one last confrontation before the new Congress is sworn in Sunday. The COVID-19 portion of the bill revived a weekly pandemic jobless benefit boost, this time $300, through March 14, as well as the popular Paycheck Protection Program of grants to businesses to keep workers on payrolls. It extends eviction protections, adding a new rental assistance fund. Americans earning up to $75,000 will qualify for the direct $600 payments, which are phased out at higher income levels, and there is an additional $600 payment per dependent child. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and Happy New Year!